Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, one of the nation's leading experts on Iran, up on Capitol Hill, which certainly has been interesting over the past 24 or so hours. Ilan, thanks so very much for joining us. Happy New Year and welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Vago. Great to be here. I'm actually, you know, in my undisclosed bunker, which is my man cave at my home in Maryland. So, although because Capitol Hill is, as you say, very interesting at the moment.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Crisis with Iran and tensions between the United States and Iran, and indeed the international community, are ongoing. The incoming Biden team is talking about not only resuscitating in some manner the Iran nuclear deal, but then adding to it ballistic missiles, which were taken off. Interestingly, Wendy Sherman was one of the negotiators of that. Tony Blinken obviously is going to be nominated as the Secretary of State, and Wendy is for the number two at the State Department. But Jake Sullivan has also said that there should also be behavioral incentives at that. Tensions are running high because we're just past the first anniversary of the assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Talk to us a little bit about what we're seeing now, because in this phase of tensions, the Iranians have said that they're going to go back to 20% enrichment. The Iranians may be a lot of things, but they're not stupid, and they realize they're going to be negotiating. Talk to us about where we stand right now, and what is the posturing, and what is the laying of groundwork for negotiation with the incoming administration.
Sure. And I actually think that's exactly the right place to start, because that's precisely what the Iranians are doing now. All these recent moves that you've seen the Iranians do with regard to the nuclear file, the announcement that they are stepping up enrichment to 20%, which experts here in the U.S., but also in Europe have correctly said that, you know, it has no reliable, feasible civilian applications. This is really a signaling move that they're moving ahead towards in the direction of weapons grade enrichment, as well as the announcement that the head of the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization, Ali Akbar Salehi, made in the last 36 hours that they were adding additional centrifuges to allow that ramp up to happen faster. All of that is an attempt by the Iranians to build bargaining power with the incoming Biden administration, because let's be clear. The Iranians have said in the past that there wasn't going to be a renegotiation of the 2015 nuclear deal. But the reality is there's absolutely going to be renewed negotiations. And the reality is has to do with the fact that the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy over the last year and a half has been very successful in building American leverage by degrading the Iranian economy, by imposing real economic and political costs on the Iranian regime. And since now there's going to be a changing of the guard in Washington later this month, the Iranians know that the Biden administration is going to be look more favorably on the idea of a sort of a more negotiated settlement, a more negotiated modus vivendi between Washington and Tehran. Their job number one right now is to rebuild their leverage in advance of going into those talks.
And what's the right mindset for the United States as it seeks to return to a leadership position on the international community on this issue and others? What's the approach that Washington has to take? What is the approach the Biden administration has to take to not just, right? Because at this point, we're on the declining end of the Iranian nuclear deal, right? I mean, from this point forward, the pressures were being more toward alleviating than being tougher, right? So what does the administration have to do to not just get back the Iran nuclear deal, set the clock back, and then add nuclear weapons to it, plus have good behavior incentives, which the Biden administration wants, right? I mean, this is a very complicated puzzle. What's the right approach to getting to where we want to be in this and getting the Iranians to sign up? and to get all of our international partners, by the way, to sign up as well.
Right. And that last portion, the international partners, it becomes a key one, because it's not a secret that the European Union is very much a stakeholder in the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear deal, that they are working as hard as they can to preserve the JCPOA, to to preserve the contours, at least the four corners of the agreement. So I think for the Biden administration, going back into this conversation, it has to, there's essentially two watchwords. The deal, the new deal, or sort of the renegotiated deal, has to be longer and it has to be stronger. Longer because, as you said, the original 2015 deal was time limited and we're already on the downslope of that timeframe. Most of the provisions will sunset in the next 3 to 4 years. Some of them, like the UN arms embargo, have already sunset. And it doesn't make any strategic sense for the US to bind itself back into an agreement that's already more than half expired time-wise. The right. Second is the stronger component, which is that the Obama administration, when it originally negotiated the contours of the JCPOA, there were moves made by the US negotiators to, for example, take ballistic missiles out of the scope of work of the original agreement because it was a hiccup, it was a hangnail that the Iranians objected to. The Biden administration, as it thinks about how to renegotiate this, is going to have a really hard job of trying to expand the scope of this new agreement to include the things that the Iranians don't really want to talk about. The Iranians originally really wanted to talk about the nuclear program because they understood that it was a framework for delay, not for fundamentally derailing their program. Are they going to be willing to talk about their ballistic missile program? Are they going to be willing to talk about their regional activities? My sense is they're going to be much more reluctant to do that.
But at the end of the day, right, there are inducements to get you to what you want to accomplish. At the time, we took the weapons off the table because the focus was to try to get a nuclear deal through, because that was the abiding concern, right? I mean, and as everybody at the time negotiated, it wasn't to try to make the Iranians good guys, was trying to get this issue off the table and then use it as leverage to drive an opening of the economy, to drive Iranians to make better decisions on everybody's behalf, on their behalf, on the behalf of, for example, their citizens who've been suffering under the yoke of these sanctions. And as Iranians would tell you, we're sort of sick and tired about as one of the world's great civilizations to be sort of seen as the perennial bad guy. What are the ways that the administration can do this?
No, that's exactly right. And you know, back half a decade ago, when we negotiated this the first time, there was very clearly, you know, to borrow a phrase from the late, great Daniel Patrick Moynihan, there was a tendency to define Iran's deviancy down, right? We had lots of problems with Iran. We decided to focus on just one aspect that was problematic, their nuclear program. But, you know, as the president-elect, as his team has said repeatedly in their discussions about this over the last couple of months, a lot of things have happened, including, you know, intensification of Iranian regional activity, including and increasing signs of sophistication in the Iranian ballistic missile arsenal. It's going to be very hard for the Biden administration, as they negotiate this, to define that deviancy down once again and just focus tactically on Iran's nuclear program. That's why there's an emphasis more and more on making the deal broader and bringing in other things that the U.S. increasingly sees as being indispensable to curbing Iranian activities.
Right, but what I'm interested in is the Europeans do want to work with the United States. There's a sense that we don't know where Russia and China will fall on this, because obviously they have their own interests, and the Russians and Chinese are very good at roping this and connecting it to something else that they want to achieve at the end of the day, right? As opposed to just sort of being like, hey, let's all work together to solve this problem and not cross-connect it to something else. But at the end of the day, what are some of the things that the Biden team can do? What are the things they can do with sanctions, right? I mean, if you were going to be creating that dossier for Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and Wendy Sherman and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, what would you put into this package that you think would be ways to get us where we want this to go and bring the international community with us?
Well, I think that's really sort of where the conversation has to start. And the to me, the orienting point is to acknowledge and sort of really appreciate how much leverage the U.S. now has over Iran, because my sense is that the administration is heading in the direction of graduated sanctions relief in exchange for changes in Iranian behavior. And that's something that's not uncontroversial. It's something that's being debated right now within the Biden team, because there are advisors to the president-elect who say that, you know, in order, as a show of good faith, the U.S. needs to give preemptive concessions to the Iranian regime. But if we go that route, it's rather dangerous, because it creates a situation where all of this economic pressure that is still existing, and that exists through not only through congressional action, but also through unilateral executive orders, have set the table for the Biden administration in a way that it allows them to tell the Iranians that we will turn down the volume, turn down the pressure in exchange for material changes in how Iran moves around in the region, the transparency of its nuclear program, the transparency of its ballistic missile program, right? There's a path here that can be followed. But my sense is it starts with understanding where we are currently, because if you listen to the Iranians, you might be lulled into a sense that maximum pressure isn't biting, and the Iranians remain defiant and remain strong. But if you look empirically at the economic data coming out of the Islamic Republic, the story is very different. And appreciating that is, I think, a very good starting point.
Wouldn't you say, though, that toughness on Iran, right? I mean, if you're showing that there is a beneficent but leadership-oriented Joe Biden entering office, wouldn't it be best to be tough across the board and negotiate it down from that toughness, right? That if you're tough with Russia, China, and Iran, a degree of consistency or even toughness there might signal appropriately to others that we're willing to strike a deal, but we're going to be tough, principled, and bring our ally, right? I mean, this would seem to be a net opportunity to bolster that global message of toughness, as opposed to negotiating away something preemptively in exchange for what? I'll give you two burgers today if you'll be nice next week. Why don't you be nice for 3 weeks and then I'll give you two burgers?
No, that's precisely right. And that's exactly my point, which is that the U.S., particularly in rebuilding this international consensus about Iran and about the need to isolate Iran, is sort of going into this with a tailwind anyway, because there is very much across the Atlantic a sense that the Biden administration is going to sort of work more diligently to take into account European concerns, take into account the concerns of international organizations and our international partners. And that's where this signaling becomes so important. If it looks like Washington and the new team in Washington is going to preemptively give away the store, it sets the stage for a much more permissive environment internationally, not only for Iran, but also for countries like Russia and China. So I think this is a very crucial pivot point.
Let me ask you about the, it's been the first anniversary since Qasem Soleimani's assassination. What is, he led the Quds Force, obviously, a force absolutely critical to exerting Iranian influence throughout the region. How did his death change things, and where is that network today compared to where it was a year ago?
I think that's really a crucial point. We've just passed a few days ago, just passed the 1 year anniversary of his killing. And it's very clear, and it's useful to sort of to go back a year and to remember where we were. Qasem Soleimani was historically seen as an Iranian official who was frankly too big to fail, too big to be targeted, too important to really be taken off the board. And the Trump administration did that regardless. And in doing so, it created a very interesting scenario where Qasem Soleimani, who was the connective tissue between the IRGC, the Islamic Republic, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and all these assorted Shiite militias in places like Iraq, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and you know, assorted elements in Syria and other places, that he was sort of gone. The chief representative of the Iranian regime was suddenly no longer there. And for a moment, there was a slackening of ideological bonds between these proxies and the Islamic Republic itself. And this was so because Soleimani's replacement military commander by the name of Ismail Ghani, was not a Middle East guy. He was a Southwest Asia guy. He had sort of cut his teeth in Afghanistan. He didn't really understand the Syrian terrain, didn't understand the Iraqi terrain. And so there was a moment where we could have followed up on Soleimani's killing by continuing to attrit the Iranian threat network in the region. But we didn't do that. And so what you have now is a situation where the proxy network that Iran has cultivated over the last quarter century still exists. It's maybe not quite as robust as it was when Soleimani was in charge, but it's far from a spent force. And it's increasingly capable and coherent now. And we've sort of, you know, we missed an opportunity to really follow through and seize the advantage.
One of the achievements that you and many others have credited the Trump administration with were the Abraham Accords, even though they're more about normalizing Israel's relationships in the region as opposed to advancing sort of what you would consider to be the core of Arab-Israeli peace in terms of the Palestinians. Although supporters of the president say this creates pressure to be able to eventually get that deal. But more importantly, it does put a lot of very important nations on the same page, whether it's Bahrain, whether it's the United Arab Emirates or the Moroccans. We can discuss concessions later. But the question is, how does this improve the leverage that the United States and the international community have? Or is this leverage that we would have had anyway, right? Does it effectively change the pressure that's being able to be exerted onto Tehran?
Well, this is one of those key things, I think, that Biden advisors talk about when they talk about a changed region, because the reason, at least in my mind, the reason the Abraham Accords are so significant is that they build upon pre-existing and sort of quiet, tacit ties that were built all around the sort of the shared concern over Iran, right? They are now more, right? There's still that security.
And they're public, right? I mean, they've been nurtured over the past 15 or so years, but now they're fully out in the open.
And those ties are no longer just about Iran. They're also about economics. They're also about, you know, sort of political normalization and things like that. But
technology, culture also at the end of the day.
Exactly. Travel, transport, trade, right? But the Iran issue sits at the core of all this. And so what you have now for the incoming administration in Washington is a Middle Eastern consensus about how to essentially contain the Islamic Republic. This is something that, you know, existed in nascent form back in the Obama administration, even back in the Bush 2 administration. But it's much more coherent now. It's much more robust now. And so my sense is that, if is, of course, the operative word, but if the Biden administration plays its hand properly, it can leverage this sort of this new normal in the Middle East as a way of advancing its priorities vis-a-vis Iran. But this is obviously a double-edged sword, because if there's an appearance on the part of the administration that it's leaning too heavily in favor of Iran, the way Middle Eastern countries perceived the Obama administration to do, then it will cost us in the coin of political ties and reputation in the region.
How does the Biden administration then deal with the entire Saudi Arabia UAE question, but not just over Yemen, where there is still discord, as you know, among members of Congress, but specifically the Jamal Khashoggi killing, which many even in the international community think that the Trump administration gave Riyadh and Mohammed bin Salman a full pass, that there needs to be some penalty paid here.
Right. And my sense is that the Biden administration, when it comes into office, is going to have a much sterner approach towards Saudi Arabia, including, essentially interacting more with Congress about the need to impose penalties on Saudi Arabia for the Khashoggi killing and for other human rights abuses. But look, I think the way the administration is going to be thinking about Saudi Arabia is going to be colored by two things. First of all, it's going to be colored by the Iran question itself. Mohammed bin Salman is going to have less entree to this White House, to the incoming White House, than he has to the current one. But the way the Saudis message to Washington about the threat from Iran, about what the region needs in order to feel protected, about what the U.S. can't do in negotiations, is still going to be very important. And the second has to do with Saudi Arabia's larger role in the region, because it's very clear that Mohammed bin Salman, despite all of his excesses and his authoritarian tendencies, has uncorked something very fundamental in Saudi society in terms of transformation. The motivations for that, we can debate and we can talk about. I tend to look at MBS much more as a transformer than a reformer. He's trying to transform society to make it more acceptable for international investment. But even those things that he's done so far have tremendous value, because over time, those changes get locked into Saudi society. And Saudi Arabia, which just a few years ago was in a very different place, culturally, socially, and even politically, the longer it continues on this trajectory, the more benign the results are going to be. And so I think the Biden White House is going to need to keep that in mind as it tries to formulate a new Saudi strategy.
Let me ask you two more questions. What has the United States, Ilan, been trying to accomplish with its use of force in the region? We've had B-52s flying around. The USS Nimitz was in the Gulf. It was coming home. Then it turned and went back. What's the United States been trying to accomplish? Because many looking at this have been a little bit perplexed, especially because U.S. forces are withdrawing from the country, right? I mean, this is very much a case where there are folks who are looking at this and saying, look, I mean, we're reducing our footprint and the Iranians are still there, even though the Iraqi government is right now in economic as well as political chaos, although I'm not necessarily sure that's newsworthy. What are we trying to accomplish, and what's the situation now in Iraq? And how does Iraq play into this, given that Iran is the number one player in Baghdad?
Right. Well, my sense is that it has the answer has everything to do with timing, because all of these tactical military moves that the Trump administration has made with regard to repositioning forces, with regard to what appears to be de-escalation, preemptive de-escalation, what surrounded the 1 year anniversary of the killing of Qasem Soleimani. And, you know, it's very hard to divorce what's happening from the notion that, you know, there are widespread fears that the, you know, revenge is a dish best served cold, and the Iranians were going to use the anniversary as an opportunity to strike out at American allies or American interests, but very likely to do so in an asymmetric fashion. And that's where Iraq comes in, because Iran still has tremendous political sway and strategic sway in Iraq. There was a sense that the Iranian response, if it did make a response, would come in the form of some action against U.S. interests or U.S. forces. And so I tend to read the repositioning of U.S. troops in the region as a signal to the international community that the U.S. was standing down, so that if there was some sort of provocation, that America has clean hands. This is clearly Iran as the instigator. And it would sort of create a more permissive environment for the U.S. to respond than it would otherwise.
Ilan, before we go, I want to ask you about the events that happened up on Capitol Hill yesterday. It stunned the world. You're a conservative Republican. Ronald Reagan is one of your patron saints, the man who talked about the shining city on the hill, and somebody who preached the message of democracy as an important weapon, and certainly one of the most important weapons we had during the Cold War. At the end of the day, what are the implications for America over the long term? Donald Trump will be no longer president in 2 weeks, but this action will still be regarded by some with astonishment. The first time the United States Capitol has been breached since the War of 1812 by American insurrectionists who are being propelled effectively by lies and disinformation, right? The fundamental thing they are protesting did not happen. The 2020 election was not fraudulent. Donald Trump lost on his own.
So I think the implications of this are huge. They're huge for two reasons. You know, first of all, in terms of domestic political cohesion, but more germane to our conversation, in terms of how the U.S. is perceived by foreign publics. Right? Because there's a couple of very clear lessons that are being drawn from this. First of all, for authoritarians, whether they're in Beijing or in Moscow or in Tehran, there is a message that can be conveyed back to domestic populations that are suffering under authoritarian or totalitarian rule that, you know, the US, which opposition activists and dissidents have historically looked to as that shining city on a hill, is actually kind of a mess internally, and it's not a model to emulate. This is something that I promise will be used in domestic political rhetoric by people like Xi Jinping, by people like Vladimir Putin, as a way of strengthening their own position. And the second lesson to me, the big one, is that disinformation works. What we know is that over the last couple of years, Russia and China and Iran have all ramped up their disinformation efforts, their soft power propaganda and false messaging efforts very substantially. And they're doing that not because this is low cost, although it is, but because it's very effective. And we're seeing the results of this. We're seeing the results of political messages that have been amplified not only by domestic actors here in the US, but also by disinformation efforts on the part of foreign governments with spectacular effect. And so as we look forward, this is a technique that is low cost, very high return, very high reward for all these countries. And my sense is they're going to lean into this moving forward.
Ilan, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.